Saw the story earlier this week and was just fascinated by it. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. We'll find out in a minute. Joachim Rannenberg, a Norwegian resistance fighter who sabotaged Nazi Germany's nuclear weapons ambitions during World War II, died this week at the age of 99. In 1943, he led a top-secret raid on a heavily guarded plant in Norway's southern region of Telemark. Rannenberg later worked as a radio journalist, helped raise awareness of the dangers of war among the young. He told the BBC in 2013 that he only realized the importance of the mission after atomic bombs were dropped on Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. "He is one of our great heroes," Norway's prime minister told NTB news agency. Rannenberg is probably the last of the best-known resistance fighters to pass away. Born in 1919, Rannenberg fled Norway after the Nazis invaded in 1940. The then 21-year-old escaped with 8 friends by boat to Scotland, but was determined to return and fight. Germany at the time needed so-called heavy water with an extra atomic particle in its hydrogen nucleus in its race against the Allies to produce an atomic bomb. Large amounts of heavy water, or deuterium oxide, at that time were only made at the Norsk Hydro facility in Telemark. This made the largest hydroelectric plant of its type a target for the resistance, but a small team tasked with destroying it in 1942 failed. The following year, Rannenberg chose a team of 5 other commandos in an Allied operation codenamed Gunnerside. "We were a gang of friends doing a job together," he told the BBC during the 70th anniversary of the mission. Listen to how they did this. This is where it gets interesting and crazy. The men parachuted onto a plateau, skied across country, descended into a ravine, and crossed an icy river before using the railway line to get into the plant and set their explosives. Quote, "We very often thought this was a one-way trip," he said. After the explosion, the men escaped into neighboring Sweden by skiing 200 miles across Telemark, despite being chased by some 3,000 German soldiers. He described it as, quote, "the best skiing weekend I ever had." The operation, coupled with U.S. air raids the following year, led the Germans to abandon their plans and was later described as the most successful act of sabotage of World War II. He was reluctant to talk about his experience despite numerous books, documentaries, and TV series retelling the story. Broke his silence in the 70s when he began raising awareness of the dangers of war among young people. Joining us on the phone right now is Alan Wright, who had the pleasure of interviewing this gentleman some time past. We wanted to get a little more insight on the man and the story behind it. Alan Wright is on the phone with us right now. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Matt. Very good, and we've got very similar weather in England as you have in Chicago. It's cold, wet, and windy.
Well, and we've got a lot of that coming. I imagine you do, too, although that's how we think of London, as cold, wet, and windy kind of year-round. Is that unfair of us to think that way, Alan?
Oh, we've had a good summer. I live on the northeast coast of Newcastle, you know, just before the Scottish border. And the funny thing about my patch, I live right next to the sea, so that keeps us warm. But 10 miles from here, there's snow on the ground today, would you believe, a little higher up. So we've got a winter a little early.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it's ahead of us. Let's talk a little bit. Is Joachim how you pronounce his first name?
Yeah, you've got it spot on, Matt. Oh, Joachim Rannenberg.
Joachim Rannenberg. Just a fascinating story. I feel terrible that I don't know my history well enough that I had never heard this story at all until this week. I can't believe that the most famous movie was back in 65. This sounds like my guess is that this story got around this week, and in Hollywood there's producers snapping this up saying we need to remake this story because it sounds like a James Bond movie in a way, doesn't it?
It really does. I remember Joachim saying to me about the film, I said, what did you think of Heroes of Telemark, as you say, made in 65? And I'll tone it down for your audience. He said, Hollywood rubbish. He wasn't impressed. He thought they took the skeleton of a story and, in his words, messed it up. But it would be brilliant if somebody did do a modern remake with the facilities they have now and get the story right. But he's one of these guys, you know. I was a BBC presenter on radio in England for 25 years. So it's wonderful being on the other end of a microphone today, Matt. It's very enjoyable. But the thing about Joachim was, I do a lot of work on the speaking circuit and hosting conferences. And a company called Hydro Polymers, who actually owned the factory in Norway during the war, the Norsk Hydro plant, they were having a big celebration. And they'd invited Joachim Rannenberg to come as their guest of honor to talk about what happened back in 1943.
Wow.
And one of his best lines at the event was, he said to me, do you know, he said, it must be the first time ever somebody's been invited as guest of honor to a dinner after he's blown up one of their factories.
Yeah, I imagine so.
But so such a modest man and perfect English. I have a lot of Norwegian friends and a large number of people in Norway speak English better than we do. But he spoke perfectly, and he's such a modest man, you know. I said, heroes of Telemark. He said, we weren't heroes. He said, we were young men doing a job that needed doing. And, you know, he was 23 when he led this mission. Can you imagine, you know, guys listening to the program today at 23, just starting out in life.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, they thought it was a suicide mission. They all carried cyanide tablets so they could kill themselves if it went wrong. Can you imagine that?
Did they really? Wow. Yeah, that is amazing. And to think not only the risk of parachuting in and setting explosives and hoping you can get away, but the amazing lengths they had to go to. It sounds like they parachuted in and then had an incredibly long journey from there to get where they had to go. And they must have, I'm guessing, parachuted in with explosives on their backs. If they were blowing up an entire factory, they had to carry all that with them, correct?
Yeah, you're hitting the ground, as you say, carrying explosives and detonators. And the thing that Joachim was carrying, which made me laugh out loud, he'd been in London not long before, and he'd gone shopping. And he was passing a hardware store, and he saw this little pair of shears, like bolt cutters.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, I wonder if they'd come in handy. So he bought some himself, put them in his bag along with the explosives. And when they actually got round the back of the plant they wanted to sabotage, there was just one thing stopping them, a chain. So he took these little bolt cutters he bought in London out of his pocket and snipped through it. Without them, they couldn't have got in.
It would have sabotaged the entire project. That's amazing.
Yeah, and he said after the war, he sent a bill for the bolt cutters to the Minister of Defence in London. And he's still waiting for the money.
How big was the factory, and how many explosives in general do you think they had to put down?
About a dozen, I believe, because the place that was there, I think you mentioned in your excellent introduction, that the factory had been there a while, and they were actually making this heavy water for fertilizer use, so the factory was already there. And when the Germans invaded Norway, they took it over, and as you said, the heavy water, key component of an atomic weapon, so it had been there a while. And once Joachim and his team got inside, they identified where they needed to be, and they planted about a dozen explosives on the big tanks where the water was, the cables, the control panels, to make sure it was all well and truly destroyed. And all of the tanks went, all of the water went down into the river, and by the time it blew up, they were out of the place, and as you say, chased by about 3,000 soldiers, but Norwegian guys can ski very well, and they didn't have a chance of catching them, really.
All right, so this is what I didn't know. So I don't know why, as I'm picturing it from the story I read, I'm just picturing them outside the plant, you know, planting explosives at various points. So they actually got in. Was this after hours?
Yeah.
Was there nobody there as they were sneaking around planting the bombs?
Well, that's the amazing thing. I mean, as you mentioned, if you can picture this huge ravine, if you imagine the Grand Canyon, but a bit smaller, but not much. They couldn't go across the bridge because obviously it was heavily defended with armed soldiers. So the way they did it, remember this is ice and snow on the ground, they abseiled down, way down, you know, about the height of the Grand Canyon, crossed a frozen river by stepping across a little ice bridge, then abseiled up the other side. They couldn't go in the front of the plant, it was too heavily defended, so they went round the back, they used these bolt cutters to clip their way in, and then they couldn't get through the next door. But Joachim told me he noticed there was a huge tunnel which carried pipes and cables, and they were quite fit young men, so they managed to wriggle in, can you believe, along there, pulling the explosives behind them.
Oh my
God. And Joachim told me when I interviewed him, at one point, the bag behind him, which had explosives and detonators, got stuck. So he got hold of it and tugged it really hard, and it sprang free and hit him in the face. But can you imagine that, sir? Have a sack full of explosives and detonators. Hits you in the face. It would clear my mind, that kind of thing happening. But, yeah, he gets through. And the little story he told me, I don't know if this has ever been public, Matt, so you can have this scoop. When he got in there, it was pitch black. All the lights were off. And they managed to just see one guy who's sitting in the control room who was a Norwegian. He wasn't a German soldier. So they pointed a gun at him and told him what they were going to do. And said, look, you're going to have to come with us, because if you stay here, the Germans will presume you were part of the raid and you'll be shot. So he said, OK, I'm coming. He said, but I must find my glasses. He dropped his spectacles on the floor, so he's trying to find them in the dark. So Joachim and the rest of the sabotage team and this guy, can you picture this, pitch black? They've got half the German army outside, and they're scrabbling around to try to find the guy's glasses before he'd leave. So to find them, then he does. And they took him with him, as he said, 200 miles to Sweden to save his life.
Wow, that is amazing. And a good thing, I guess, that guy was on board and not, you know, a Nazi sympathizer or anything like that, right?
Yeah, nobody with a gun. But what I was really pleased with, this interview I did with Joachim some while back now, I think you mentioned for a long time after the war, he wouldn't talk about it much. Yeah. And like a lot of brave people, you know, you must have met people. I remember interviewing people who've landed at D-Day or landed during invasion of the islands in the Pacific during the war. And guys who've seen the worst of war will often not want to say much about it. But when I did the interview with him at this conference, happily, there were some young guys there, some young men and women who worked for Hydro, and they'd never heard the story before. And I remember saying to Joachim on stage, look, it's really important you let these young people know how it was, because, you know, happily, a lot of us have not seen war, but can you imagine, you know, you mentioned about nuclear bombs. Joachim said, you're right, Alan, he said, the story needs to be told. He said, can you imagine if they had built a nuclear weapon, you know, the pictures we've seen of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombs in 45, that would have been how London or New York or Los Angeles looked if the Germans had the atomic bomb. I mean, it was as important as that.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it would have changed the course of everything. I think there's a TV show on, I don't watch, but about what if, you know, we would have lost World War II and what would things be like now? It would have changed everything. I imagine there would have been war for a long time, or, you know, I can't imagine things would have gone on like they are now. I imagine there still would have been war going on and resistance forever.
Yeah.
So it's, people like that are amazing that did the small pieces that led to the overall victory. Now, that factory was rebuilt. Is there a factory there today, a Hydro facility?
There's still a Hydro facility. After Joachim and his team had bombed it, it was out of action for about 5 months, and the Germans tried to rebuild it. And the day they finished rebuilding it, the Royal Air Force bombed it and destroyed it again. But it was quite hard to get the actual heavy water, because it was way down in a cellar under a mountain, effectively, and it could drop really heavy bombs and it wouldn't make much difference. But what really finished them off, as the war started to go the way of the British and the Americans and their allies, they realized that very soon they wouldn't be able to hold Norway. So what they tried to do was take all the facility back to Germany, away from the bombers. So they had everything they needed, crossing a lake near the plant. So the bit of heavy water they had, plus all the machinery, all of the technical stuff, and some other saboteurs, friends of Joachim, actually put a mine on the ferry and timed it so it blew up in the middle of the lake and sank the lot. So that was the end of the German nuclear program. Because the amazing thing about Joachim, it wasn't just this thing he did. He continued right through the war, acts of sabotage, you know, blowing up railway lines and all the rest of it. But the thing I could never forget, meeting the man, you know, you sometimes see a sports story and, you know, somebody gets a touchdown or whatever and people call him a hero. I mean, he's a good football player, but he's not a hero. Joachim Gronenberg certainly was just the most amazing man. And I've had the pleasure as a speaker of, you know, getting around the world and telling his story. And it's young people who always get me. I remember talking in a university recently, so the audience were between about 18 and 22. They'd never heard the story before. And one young lady came to me, and she said, that was incredible. She said, I hadn't realized that without one guy, you know, and she was looking out, and we had the Union flag, the British flag flying outside the university. She said, without him, that would have been a swastika. And it's exactly like that. You know, you sound as though you're like me, a bit of a fan of alternative history and alternative fiction, and the series I'm watching at the moment, The Man in the High Castle.
Yeah, that's the one I was referring to, right, Man in High Castle, yes.
Yeah.
I need
incredible. I'd recommend it. Anybody haven't seen it, it's on Amazon. And they always kick off with their opening map, and the eastern half of the United States is part of the...
Oh, we lost you there for a second, Alan. Are you there? Ah! I guess we're not set to get the spoiler for Man in High Castle. Just we lost Alan, I think, there for a second. I'll tell you what, we'll take a commercial break, see if we can reconnect with him. We'll be back, 720 WGN. I think we were able to reconnect with Alan. Let me see if I've got him back there. Alan, sir, are you there?
Yeah, standing by, Matt.
Sorry about that. We had a little trouble with the phone. I forget what you were saying now as we lost you on the air there a minute or two ago. But
I was talking about the effect on young people. I have the pleasure on the speaking circuit sometimes with universities, and I remember a young woman, she was only 19, 20 perhaps. She'd never heard the story before. And she was staggered at what a difference, you know, one guy and his friends had made to history. You know, quite incredible, really.
Yeah, and that, and then you were telling us about the High Castle show, and you were saying that at the beginning they start with a map, and what is it, the eastern half of the United States?
Yeah, they have the eastern half of the United States part of the German Nazi Empire. Then there's a kind of neutral zone down the middle, kind of Rockies and so on, and on the western half is part of the Japanese Empire. And, you know, we often forget how close it came, and because I was born, I guess, not long after the war, I have this fascination. I grew up being told about uncles I never met who had lost their lives during the war, and I always wanted to find out more and more about what happened.
Yeah.
And I guess people like Joachim Wallenberg, they're a symbol of the incredible number of young people from all over the world who lost their lives to keep freedom. And I remember a little while back, I was making a documentary about D-Day, and there was a cross in France going around the D-Day beaches and the cemeteries there.
Yes.
And you get so much of a feel of this, and you're looking at gravestones of young guys who, I think the youngest one I saw was 17, who'd lost his life during D-Day. And I took my grandson with me, and I think it's so important for young people to get a feel of this, and happily he's got this book for history now. And I was so proud, you know, we were walking through the American cemetery in Normandy, and the sun was shining, it was a beautiful day. And there are all these, it's heartbreaking, all these white memorial stones, and normally the lettering's in black. And we could see from a distance, the sun was catching one gravestone picked out with gold lettering. And the leader of the group said to us, does anybody know why it's gold? And none of us did, including me. My grandson said, is it because he held the Medal of Honor? And it was. And we got up to the gravestone. It was Theodore Roosevelt Jr.
Wow.
And anybody who held the Medal of Honor was given gold letters on his stone. And you're looking at these, you know, young men who gave their lives. And without these guys who lost their lives all over the world, you know, during the early 40s, we wouldn't be sitting having this conversation now. You and I would have, you know, Secret Service guy on our shoulder telling us to be careful what we say and all the rest of it. You know, freedom would have completely gone.
Yeah, you're right. Well, Alan, I've been to London and I've been in the war rooms and they're amazing. And I've been over to Normandy and I've been in that cemetery. And it is breathtaking to stand there and think about and to really be there and to think about what happened on that soil and the sacrifices that were made and the whole world kind of coming together to fight against that. And it is a magnificent piece of history, and thank you for helping tell the story of Joachim Wallenberg, one of the great resistance fighters of World War II, who maybe without him we wouldn't be able to be here having this conversation today. Alan, where can people find out a little bit more about you? Is there a website where they can see what you've been presenting or writing or anything like that? Can we visit you online?
Yeah, it's you can do it two ways. Not the easy way, if you just Google my name's Alan, A-L-A-N. And Wright is W-R-I-G-H-T, so Alan Wright, and speaker, as in speaker at conferences. So perhaps the easiest way, if you Google Alan Wright speaker, it'll take you right to my website, and if you'd like that one, it's 3 W's dot, then all one word, after dinner speaker, alanwright.co.uk, and that'll always find me day or night.
So after dinner speaker, Alan Wright, all one word, after dinner speaker, Alan Wright, dot UK or dot co.uk?
Dot co.uk.
Co.uk. And do you have a Twitter handle or anything like that, Alan?
Yeah, sure. But I'm getting so technical now to say, you know, when I used to work in broadcasting, we edited tapes with a razor blade and a yellow pencil. So I was there a long time. But it's the Twitter one. It's at Alan Hartlepool. Hartlepool is my hometown. So at Alan Hartlepool at Alan Hartlepool. That'll find me on Twitter, Matt.
Sounds great. Alan, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. I hope we talk again.
I hope we will, and I'll wave to you shortly. I'm speaking in the United States the week after next, so changing planes at JFK. I'll wave to Chicago on the way past and then down to Colombia in South America.
Oh, excellent. Well, have a great trip, and we'll stay in touch.
Look forward to seeing you again. Thanks,
right,
Matt.
Sir. Thank you very much. Again, Joachim Wallenberg, check out the story online and make sure to listen to this podcast or share it with people who you think might enjoy hearing that story, because it is amazing. And now I'm going to have to look for the movie from 1965, Heroes of Telemark, starring Kirk Douglas. I never heard of it, but I will take a look for it now.
Good movie.
Is it? You've seen it, Raj?
Mm-hmm.
All right, 4:31 in the morning. Let's check some headlines with Mr. Badish.